Welcome to It's All Journalism. My name is Michael O'Connell. Today we're talking comics, comics and journalism, journalism and comics. I've got with me today Julie O'Donoghue, who is now an official producer with our show.
Yes.
Welcome.
Happy about that.
Happy about that. And we're happy about that as well. And we're talking to Josh Kramer, who is the editor of the Cartoon Picayune.
Hey, how are you guys?
Okay.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me. Let's start. What is the comics, or pardon me, the Cartoon Picayune?
Okay. Sure. So it is a twice annual zine. I guess magazine's fair. It is a. shoot, I'm sorry.
You thought this podcasting stuff was going to be easy,
I know, right? So it's journalism in the form of comics. It's about the size of like an old TV guide.
It's like a digest.
Yeah, it's like 5.5 by 8.5. And it's in black and white, color covers with different stories that are all about real people and true stories, but in the form of comic books.
So did you come into this type of thing as a cartoonist, as somebody who's interested in journalism, as a little bit
sure.
of both?
Yeah, can you tell us about your background?
Yeah, absolutely. I went to American University just up the street from here, and I did an undergrad in their School of Communications and just thought I was going to go into normal journalism like everyone else thought they were going to.
And make tons of
yeah.
money.
Yeah. But I was also a comics fan, and I loved picking up my weekly books and reading graphic novels and everything. My best friend came back from studying abroad in Croatia, and he brought with him a book by Joe Sacco called, I said that weirdly, Joe Sacco, called Safe Area Garazda.
And it's great.
It's one of my favorite books. It's a very complicated story in comics form about all the history in the Balkans, the recent history in the Balkans, and kind of opened my eyes to the possibility of telling nonfiction stories in the comics medium. And so I kind of, from there, started thinking about how I could tell the journalistic stories that I like, things like This American Life is a great example. Like, how could I do that in comic books? And from there, I went to, I graduated from American 2009, and I went to a small school in Vermont. It's called the Center for Cartoon Studies. It's an amazing two-year MFA program that basically allows you to take time off from the world and go make comics. So it's a first year is very intensive, lots of courses like drawing and, yeah, all sorts of figure drawing, comics history. The teachers are amazing, and you really get immersed, and you're in this tiny community of like 75 people in this town of 2,500 in the middle of Vermont. And from there, my second year is a thesis year, and so Josh Neufeld was my mentor and advisor, and he wrote a book called After the Deluge, which is a book about Hurricane Katrina and its effects on the city of New Orleans. And with his help and the help of my classmates and everything, I kind of came up with the first issue of the Cartoon Picayune. And from there, I've been doing it here. I moved back to D.C., and yeah, now I publish it from here. And so, yeah, I'm the editor. I do stories in it, and I bring in all sorts of contributors as an anthology.
Now, had you been an artist before you went to the MFA program?
Not really. I always liked to draw, but I never had the knack for it. I mean, I never was one of those kids who had to be doodling all the time compulsively. I was never one of those people. And, you know, starting around 2009, I just really, like, pushed it into my application and drew the very best that I knew how, and I barely made it in. I like to tell people, like, they had to have me submit an additional sample of my work to prove that I would be able to handle the drawing of the course load. And from there, I mean, I feel confident in my ability. You know, it's I'm really happy that the Cartoon Picayune now is at a point where I can pull in people who can draw better than me, but I still like to do my own work, and I feel like I'm a great example of the fact that anyone who is willing to do it can learn to draw in a few years.
So what makes you, you know, using cartoons to tell your story, what makes you a journalist? What are you
yeah,
looking
absolutely.
For?
Well, every story, I mean, everyone's a little bit different, but especially the way I do it, every story starts out the same. You know, you go out, you meet people, you interview them, you take notes, in my case, I take a lot more visual notes. I'm taking a lot of pictures for reference. I'm telling people, don't worry about these pictures. I'm not going to use them for anything. It's just for my own notes. But I am reporting the story like anyone else, and I'm looking for good quotes, and I'm, you know, pursuing it in that way. But like I said, I'm collecting a lot of information that's going to help me out later. So if there was a particular billboard or in the background, or if the grass was very strange or whatever, you know, like I'm going to want to know that stuff. Or if I'm, especially if I'm trying to find out about something that happened where I can't be there, mm-hmm. I'm trying to do some kind of light reconstruction, I might say. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to collect as much information as possible.
I know something that we've talked about in the past when we've had photographers or videographers in here, visual storytellers, when they talk about the way they, you know, what they choose to tell a particular story, they look for certain elements or something.
Yeah.
When you go out and, you know, think about a story, or you start talking to people and saying, well, maybe this could be a story, what elements are you looking for?
That's a great question. Yeah, it's different for everyone. But for me, I really do think that there are certain stories that are better suited to comics. Mm-hmm. I have friends that kind of take a more, like, I guess, a small C Catholic approach to comics and think that everything should be open to this medium. This is a medium that can handle everything. But for mm-hmm. me, these stories take so long to do. And you really have to be deliberate about what you choose to work on. And so for me, I want something that, yeah, like it's a visual story. You want to see what's happening. So I want to pick something where it's a good story. First and foremost, like I want something that is a compelling narrative, or like, you know, you don't know that going in necessarily, but you want to at least think there's going to be a good story there. Mm-hmm. And then something that's going to look great on the page. Maybe there's like a, when you start working on it, some of that stuff comes out, but maybe there's like a visual metaphor or a way of communicating to the reader what's happening that's not completely obvious. Too.
Now, we actually first became sort of aware of your work. We had a podcast a couple of months ago where we interviewed the editors and contributors of the
Magic Bullet.
Magic Bullet.
Yeah,
thank you. I was just going to lose. And you actually had a page in there.
Uh-huh.
And in the conversation, Matt Dembicki, I think, mentioned something that you had done. And I went and I checked it out. It was for the Washington City paper. It was
yeah.
it was a 2-page spread about the food trucks. Could you tell me about that sort of project?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So this is a great concrete example. Thank you. that story, I've actually done two stories about this guy, Kirk Francis, and he owns a milk and cookies food truck.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that you're referring to in the city paper was great because it was a 2-page spread. And for me as an artist, it's a wonderful large canvas to work on. It's like mm-hmm. 20 inches across by 10 inches tall. And it was, I got to do something fun, which was I drew the food truck and got to kind of do like a cross-sectional drawing where you can like look into the truck and the little arrows explain like what's inside, like the mm-hmm. the Viking convection oven that he drives around with, and the 4G wireless card that he uses to run Square on his iPad. And I find that stuff really fascinating. And I also like remember being a kid and loving those like cross-sectional books of like the Titanic and stuff mm-hmm. like that in the Empire State Building. So for me, it's a straightforward journalistic story.
Sure.
It's kind of a light piece.
It's a feature.
It's a day in the life of this guy who does something a little bit interesting. But like, where else are you going to see something like this,
right?
Comics gives you a set of tools, or gives you a medium to apply the journalistic tools that we already have. So you can do amazing things like change the angle that a camera would never be able to get, for example,
mm-hmm.
or go reimagine a scene that there isn't any footage of.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's amazing. Comics can do anything.
Can I ask you, so I think most people associate comics with fiction,
superhero
fiction.
That's fine.
Superhero
it's a big world.
Yeah.
And there are certainly a lot of, I think, famous comics, stuff that's broken out recently happened to be memoirs. I mean,
sure.
I know Mouse is not, I don't know. I know that's not recent.
Well, Alison Bechtel's books about her family.
Yeah, absolutely. Those are the big standout books. Yeah. I mean, talking about like Fun Home, it won the best book of the year in Time Magazine in 2006. Not best graphic novel, like best book of the year. Mm-hmm. And Mouse won a Pulitzer. I mean, those are pretty significant mm-hmm. books in the culture at large. And they're very different from the kind of thing that I do. But it is helpful that more people know what comics are now. I mean, more people are aware of complicated literature
right.
in comics form. I think that's helpful. And I do think that they kind of lay the groundwork for there being a nonfiction or a true story. I know I've listened to Alison Bechtel speak a couple times. I met her, and she's very committed and very hard on herself mm-hmm. in terms of like having a very high threshold for truth and authenticity, and I appreciate that. I mean, mm-hmm. her works don't have a lot of in common with what I do.
Mm-hmm.
But
can
I
you
love
explain
her
what she does?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
So, like, Fun Home and her more recent book, Are You My Mother?
Mm-hmm.
Are memoirs, and she uses like Virginia Woolf and Sylvia Plath, and she uses texts like that to examine her own life and her mm-hmm. experiences. Very looking inward, very analytical. I mean, the new book is very much about psychoanalysis and mm-hmm. things like that. So personally, I try to keep myself out of the story. And that's another conversation, too. I mean, the guy who's most famous for comics journalism is who I started talking about is Joe Sacco. Mm-hmm. And he is in all the stories. And, you know, I've heard him say that the reason that he puts himself in the story is because he considers it an essential part of what he's trying to say. And it's a book-length narrative. And, you know, he said when he's in Sarajevo and there's a family, like, giving him clothes to bring to their loved one in Bosnia, like, there's no going back for him. He's a character. Like, mm-hmm. I think
he's part of the story because
absolutely.
He's there.
Yeah.
And I kind of feel like there's no reason to fake that. There's no reason to say, like, oh, I can't be in the story. I'm a journalist. We're coming at, like, if you kind of look at the evolution of the kinds of stories that people are used to seeing in comics, the most previous example of nonfiction is memoir. It's kind of what you're talking about.
Right.
That's what people mm-hmm. are used to. So for me, and I know you were curious about, like, is it a trend? Is this new? Is comics journalism
right.
new? And I think it's not, because there are a ton of examples of this throughout the history of illustration and comics, but what is new, maybe, is this commitment to saying, finally, yes, it is journalism, and we're going to try to live up to some standards. And I know that even Joe Sacco, like, 10 years ago, was not willing to really cast himself as a journalist. And, like, who else? What's a great example of this?
I think there was, one of the best books I've read about North Korea was done, I think it was
Guy
done
Deluxe.
By...
I can't ever pronounce his last name.
I pronounce it Diesel. We should say he's French. So
yes, he's Quebecois.
I'm sorry.
No, that's right.
He's French Canadian.
But but that's great. That's a great example because he actually goes out of his way to say that he's not a journalist. And for me, I'm opening myself up to libel law here, right? Like I'm in it, and I want people to think that it's a real story. And for me, the rules that I use to kind of set the stories that we use in the Cartoon Picayune separate from what the other stuff that's out there is nonfiction and comics is I say that every character in the books has to be a real person, right? No composite characters. I love Mouse, but I don't want you to draw people as mice as
right.
that metaphor.
That was actually going to be one of my questions.
And so that's the one thing is that everyone who's drawn on the page has to be a real person. And the other thing is that every speech bubble has to be a sourceable quote, right? Like, in theory, I should be able to look through notes and see those quotes. And I want you to be able to, like, as a contributor, I want you to be able to stand up for those quotes. But that's pretty much it. And I want there to be a degree of flexibility. I have a wonderful story in the new issue by Emmy Guinness, and it's a historical look at these women who worked in a factory in the 1930s and received excessive doses of radiation. It's called Radium Girls. And I think it's a tremendous 9-page story. But yeah, it's a little, it's not strictly journalism, maybe. It's a, definitely a historical piece. And what I love about it is that she's able to use, quotes and court documents mainly to kind of reconstruct dialogue and scenes and a treasure trove of photos from that era to make it, to grant the story verisimilitude, you might say. Like, mm-hmm. it really feels like you're there. And I think that's awesome. But that's why I don't want to say that it's the Cartoon Picayune is only contemporary journalism, because I want there to be room for stuff like that. And I love that there are people like Emmy who love those kind of stories and are willing to really, like, pursue them.
Yeah, and it, with the other podcast we had, they were also talking about the one DC...
District Comics.
District Comics.
Yeah, they did this anthology
which,
about
you know,
local stories.
I'm gonna encourage people to seek that out. It's a really good book. I'll actually put a link with this. It's just... And a lot of it is history, people going back and sort of reimagining things from photos and everything. But their research went into that.
Yeah.
They try to make it as true as possible. But, you know, one of the things that you were talking about that you sort of mentioned is you know, what makes your type of journalism different from that, that you're trying to – are you sort of making a conscious effort to go out and find contemporary stories that
– Yeah, definitely. And, you know, it's not always – a lot of it is what people are willing to pitch me or stories that I've already published and I want me to republish. Only recently have I really started taking pitches from people of ideas for stories that haven't started yet, and working with them as an editor, with them as a writer, artist, and developing that into a finished piece. The other long piece in the new issue is called Sex Workers of the World Unite. It's by Andy Warner, who's got a already kind of a career for himself as a cartoonist and illustrator. His work is on Slate and a host of other awesome venues. And his style is amazing, and his work is very compelling. And what was really great for me in this piece is I had a budget to pay him and to make it worth his while to go out and report. He had never actually like had the time or the inclination to go talk to people, record those conversations, and try to put a script together and make a comic out of that. And that is huge for me, that I have a budget to do that with.
Now, tell me about just being an editor as opposed to just being an artist and a writer yourself.
Sure.
I mean, what are you able to, you know, what do you take away from that experience as sort of the collaborative effort?
Yeah, definitely. I want my own work in there because I want to develop as a cartoonist, but it's an equal priority that I develop as an editor for me. I think... I want the Cartoon Picayune to be like a well-rounded package, and they're all around themes now. The previous issue was distress. The current one is hard work. And I want different stories that are going to reflect the theme, and I want high-quality work that is really going to pop on the page and leave a lasting impression with the reader. A lot of it is like sending emails, right? It's like anything else. It's kind of... putting the story, making sure there's enough to fill the pages. Mm-hmm. And in this case, like late in the game, there was 3 pages that we needed to fill. And that's why I have a comic in this issue.
Okay. And what's your comic? It's Feeding the Meter.
Yeah, right. And so I mentioned I did 2 stories with Kirk. And this is a second piece following up on the Milk and Cookies thing and kind of diving a little bit deeper into contemporary politics around food trucks in D.C. So it's kind of... yeah, just
we should go into explain the politics of it. That there's this big fight going on
exactly.
in the city council. That
yeah, I think it can be boiled down to there's this great opportunity for a lot of people, and they're making a lot of money selling their stuff on the street. But there's a lot of people who would prefer that they not do that as much, or where
mostly
they're doing it.
People who have brick and mortar stores.
Yeah, and I get that. I worked at a restaurant, so I totally get that. But yeah, it's kind of a mess right now. It's a fascinating mess, and it's kind of a great moment in time to take a look at it. So.
That's totally happening in Chicago too when you go there. So,
yeah.
No, and the restaurants don't realize that the people who are driving trucks around have got expenses as well.
Oh my gosh! Yeah, the truck that he made, and he made it on the cheap, And
you maybe shouldn't tell
them. Well, not on the cheap.
On the inexpensive.
I don't mean that. Yeah, exactly.
On the economic. Okay.
No, yeah, he made his truck not from a kit. Like, he bought it in West Virginia or something, and he had family work on it. And still, the truck altogether took a year to make and $30,000.
Wow. Yeah.
So if you buy it from a company that makes food trucks, it might cost upwards of $50 or more. So it's not on the cheap. It's still $30,000.
And I've seen, going with this boon, I've seen a few trucks on the side of the road waiting to be towed.
Gotcha.
Because they've broken down. Anyway, enough of food trucks and things.
Sure.
I just had a question, like, in terms of going back to the not putting yourself in the story and that type of thing. So, Joe Sacco and Guy, French Canadian. I can't pronounce his last name
either. Probably Guy.
It's probably Guy.
We'll call him Guy.
Okay.
Just because
apologies
it's fun
to our Quebecois listeners.
There is some. I mean, it's been a long time since I've looked at either of their work, but there is some, especially I know in the book about North Korea.
Sure.
We all know North Korea is pretty weird. There is some. He's not turning people into like mice or cats, but there's some liberties taken with the way people look. Like, I know
in
the book about North Korea, all of the people have really like wide kind of clown-like smiles all the time.
Yeah.
And I was wondering how you felt about that, because some of the attraction of comics is that you can sort of take some liberties with people's appearance.
Yeah, you're talking about issues about caricature and also
the
fact that it's a medium that is a visual shorthand. I mean, that's why it works so well.
Right.
Is that, that is really tricky. I mean, for me as a young artist, too, it's like, how do I portray this character who I know is African-American and make it look not offensive, but like accurate? You know, I want the reader in black and white to be able to tell that this person is an African-American. But I don't want it to be like, ugh, you know?
But, you know, sometimes I would imagine the challenge would be that, you know, there are certain conventions or, you know, techniques in storytelling, in cartoon storytelling where, you know, like people, you know, suddenly are a character themselves jumping up and down because they're angry or something.
Sure.
That, you know, that you want to illustrate a certain emotion or something. I mean, is it the tendency then that you kind of almost feel you have to be hyper realistic or as realistic as you can?
Yeah, that's a good question. I do feel like this kind of work, this subject matter, lends itself to being like, unfortunately, a little less expressive sometimes and a little bit more text heavy. And that's kind of some of the challenges, is to like, how can you say as much as possible from the perspective of the character, the real person, the source? How do you have them tell the story? And how do you not fill the whole thing? I don't want it to be a illustrated essay.
Have you ever?
And I like illustrated essays.
Have you ever seen any of the alternative work that Steve Ditko has done?
Yeah.
Where he'll have a symbolic character and then an entire page filled with text.
God. Let's not talk about late Ditko.
No, but you know, he's not unique. I mean, there are a lot of people that do that. And I was looking at your book, and it sort of makes you wonder, because, you know, cartoons are a visual medium. You know, the pictures are there for a reason.
Yeah,
they're
absolutely.
They're not just like, you know, illustrations via like a photo that you're, that's part of your storytelling technique.
Yeah, I appreciate you for making that point for me. Thank you. Yeah. I mean, it's not that, it's not that the, images are doing the job of communicating, and it's not that just the words are doing the job. It really should be a marriage. It really should be, one cannot exist without the other.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, the best stories do that, you know?
But you do put some limitation. I mean, because that's very effective. I mean, as much as we were saying, I don't want people to look like animals. I mean, that is a very effective tool that's used in Mouse. So you think that's off the table for you
depends.
A little bit?
Nothing's completely off the table. It's just like, it's a discussion maybe. So here's a great example of something where I had to kind of go back and forth a little bit about what I would want in the Cartoon Picayune. The previous issue has a wonderful story by Matt Diffie, who by trade is a New Yorker cartoonist. He does single gag panels, and he's great. He's super funny. You can see his stuff like in every issue of the New Yorker, and he he came to me and said, I have this story that I did in, I believe it was Texas Monthly. Would you like to reprint it in the Cartoon Picayune? And I said, yeah, it's
would
hilarious.
I?
Yeah. And it's, first of all, this story is super
it's
impressive.
Art.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Yeah. And it works in black and white, which I was afraid it wouldn't because it's a watercolor piece. But also, what was I going to... Yeah, this guy, this is his first multi-panel story ever, too, which is kind of unbelievable. But there's a sequence in this story, which I found myself like doing kind of a read-through before sending it off to print. And I'm asking myself, this is really funny. This is too funny. Did these people actually say this? Are these real characters? And so I emailed him and kind of like went back and forth, and it turned out that they weren't. But people that looked like that had said stuff like that while he was there. And so what we just I decided to do was to put a little disclaimer up on top of that. And it says something like that the following sequence is comedic fiction based on reportage. And I think that that's a reasonable compromise. I wanted to like put a flag to the reader that says,
right,
hey, look out. But also, I didn't want to take it out of the story because it's funny. And I think people get it, you know, especially with that note. Like, but I do. Yeah, that was kind of like the closest I've gotten to an exception to the rule.
So you sort of felt maybe a journalistic integrity is something
right.
that you needed to address.
Yeah, and it's not like...
it worked. I read
right,
it.
Okay, cool.
I saw
Thanks.
It.
Yeah, and
I saw
like,
the note.
But, you know, otherwise there'll be maybe people out there, if that's right. not there, are just going to take that as...
Yeah.
You know.
Right.
And so for me, it's not even like objectivity, right? I mean, the objectivity is kind of questionable in general. I think this is a medium where like you cannot help but being subjective because the whole thing is interpreted through your brain and your hand. It's drawn, you know, it's not as if... You know, photography is subjective because it's all edited, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not uncommon to find, like, a picture from North Korea with those, like, missiles that have been copied and pasted into the other part of the picture, if people remember that from a few years ago. But, right, it is an inherently subjective medium, but I feel like, in general, it's pretty easy to trust what's being communicated to you. Just like radio, when they explain that something's happening, you believe them
right.
that it's happening. And... For me, yeah, it's not so much objectivity. It's having a little, it's doing the due diligence and making sure that your facts are right. And also having some humility about it, saying like, you know, I'm not omnipotent. I don't know everything, but this is my best version of it.
Well, it's, you know, it's kind of interesting because I would. Do you see yourself more as an artist or a journalist or a combination of both?
A combination of both, I guess, if I'm flattering myself on a good day. yeah, I think of myself as a journalist. And
so you're constantly weighing the artistic merit of something against the...
I don't know. I think
they're necessarily mutually exclusive.
It's something not usually that hard a decision, honestly. It's not something I like wrestle over. It's not like... it's not like there's some like brilliant metaphor that I like am beating myself over the head with. Usually it's just like straightforward stories about normal people, and it makes sense in comics, you know?
Mm-hmm. So the things that make a good, comic story make a good text
piece. Oh yeah,
piece.
Totally. And I'm sure... I don't know if everyone thinks like this, but especially now doing this, like I will read an amazing essay, for example, and I'll just be like, oh, I wish I could see this. I want to like, you know, a good detailed story has you something picturing it in your mind, and I want to actually see it. That's why I think documentary is so powerful. It's no secret that people love powerful visual images to accompany narrative.
30 for 30.
Yeah.
Well,
successful.
And people tend to forget that documentaries are subjective as well.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
Right.
And whatever
sure.
the point of view is.
And I think a lot of the ethical issues are similar in documentary. Like, how do you reconstruct something that you can't get footage of is the same as, oh, I wasn't there to see it. I always think about that scene in The Thin Blue Line with the milkshake flipping through in the air, which is so powerful and goes such a long way.
It's good that his camera happened to be there to shoot that.
Yeah, right?
Exactly.
Oh, my God. Yeah, and I've heard him interviewed, and There are some people that think that he was there to shoot that milkshake
is
flying through the air.
I know.
And I'm almost like, well, maybe then that's a failure on your part, Errol Morris, because how did they possibly think
that? I don't know.
That?
Those reconstructions are pretty noir. Yeah. They're like dark and people are like walking and there are shadows
Hold
around.
On,
I know.
Yeah. Well, fair enough.
Yeah. In fact, that actually makes me uncomfortable about that documentary, even though it's beautiful.
Yeah,
or
totally.
The Paradise Lost series. I don't know if they do reconstructions in Paradise Lost, but there are things that happen there that make me a little bit uncomfortable. So you're totally right about that. So can I ask you about the financial end of this?
Sure.
So how are you supporting yourself and can you pay your contributors and all those
absolutely.
Nice
well,
things?
I should say, first of all, it's on a very small scale. I mean, I print 300 of these each time I make them and I will print more, you know, like it goes up every time I print, but I do not support myself with the Cartoon Picayune. I have a full-time job and I mean, I'm on number 5 now, and so I can kind of lay out the way that it works pretty easily. The margin is not amazing, but it works. Each issue costs less than $1.50 to print, and I sell them for $4. And I sell them in a variety of different ways, the best of which being hand-to-hand or through the internet. And that's where I sell most of them, probably. I mean, either at comics shows or... or just at like events around town. I just did a small press event that was sponsored by the Washington Project for the Arts, and I'm going to the Zine Fest on July 21st, St. Stephen's Church for those in D.C. I mean, that's the best, is to kind of meet somebody and convince them person to person that they should spend money on my art. I mean, that's hard, but it's worth it, and it creates repeat, like lifelong subscribers and everything. I have subscribers as well.
I assume you've been to the Small Press Expo up in
I'm there every year,
No, I've been the last couple of years.
It's getting bigger and bigger every year, but it's great.
But there are a lot of people in the same place that you are, that they're producing work. Some of it's, you know, hardbound, really nice printing,
totally.
Other people just doing stuff on a very low-end scale.
Yeah, and I would definitely like to play with different media, too. I mean, I would like to do a bigger... fatter version of the Cartoon Picayune that's like has a perfect bound edge and everything like that, and that when I can figure it out how to do it, I will. And I'm actually dipping my toe into like ebook territory right now, trying to figure out iPad versions and different apps that make sense, and that I hope will be another revenue stream. You asked about whether I pay creators. Generally, I'm coming from a mini comic context. You know, I'm coming from this community of artists and everything, and people don't expect to get paid, and I kind of wish that I could, but for most of the stories, I can't pay anyone. So they give me a finished story, or they tell me that they intend to make the story for me, and I more or less take it as is, you know, and I will always edit for copy edit and do kind of like light fact checking as much as possible. I have like some friends from journalism school and my girlfriend help copy edit and everything. But I will offer changes. I mean, if it's like a big copy edit thing, they have to change it. But I will offer changes and say, make as many of these as you'd like. Feel free to argue with me. You don't have to. But I mentioned that story I did with Andy, right, where I paid him for it, and we started that story together. So it started as a pitch. We went back and forth on the script a lot, and then I kind of kept a close eye on his pencil work and, well, quote-unquote pencils, because he works all on the computer, so it's kind of a whole different process than I'm used to. But pencils and then inks and then final. So basically... I exerted more of an editorial influence because I felt like I could. I was paying him for it, and I felt like it was appropriate, whereas I will offer as many edits as people want for stories I'm not paying for, but I'm not going to hold it to him. You know?
So you mentioned the artist who was drawing digitally.
Yeah,
I mean, what about the digital realm?
Sure.
I mean, as far as a publishing medium for...
Sure. I should explain, too, the way that most of these comics are made is a little bit interesting for people who aren't familiar with it. It starts just on pieces of like hard paper, a Bristol board, and, you know, it is drawing. So it's drawing with pencils, and then it's ink, usually like out of like you
India
know, dip,
ink.
Yeah, India yeah. ink out of with like a dip pen or a brush or rapidograph technical pens, and then with you know white out ink on top of that, and then you erase the pencils and you scan it in, and then it's in Photoshop, and the whole book gets made in Photoshop and InDesign, just like any other publication.
Interesting.
Yeah, and so then I have like a PDF that I send to the printer. Basically.
Okay.
And but yeah, I mean I'm working online too. I have the cartoonpicayune.com, I should mention now. It's a cartoon PICAYUNE.com. And I wanna do some publishing on there. You know, it's tricky because it's art and their copyright is a bundle of different rights that people own, and I make it clear that I don't own their stories. Like, I only have the ability to publish in print what people give me for the Cartoon Picayune. And if they want me to put it on the site, I will. But, you know, it's up to them. And so,
right.
And again, like, yeah, that's something, again, I'm kind of negotiating around ebooks too. Like, I think that if I'm actually making money off of ebooks, I want to split that off like royalties and I want to pay people. But who knows? So there are different opportunities online, too. I mean, there's a great piece of, I guess, software called ThingLink, and it's amazing for annotating images. So you kind of roll over your mouse over an image, and then you can kind of see other images nested in there, or videos or links, and it's amazing for comics because you can read the whole comic and then it's like a jumping off point to all the research that went into it and all the other relevant information. So that I really want to explore some more. And I'm thinking that almost everything that's in this new issue is going to be kind of like have like a super annotated version on the website. And I'm kind of, it's different generationally for different cartoonists. Like we were talking, one of my teachers in Vermont, Steve Bissett, he was the penciler on the famous Swamp Thing run in the 80s. Legendary.
By Alan Moore.
Yeah, absolutely. Legendary comic book artist. And he had been like screwed over by the big comic book companies over and over again. And he has every right to be bitter about that stuff. And I totally get it. His whole generation had to deal with just being treated like crap. So I'm not really coming from that place, is what I'm trying to say. Like, I look at the internet as a chance for someone to see my work in a passing way, maybe, and then maybe later they'll want to buy it. Maybe they'll be interested, or maybe they'll remember when they see it again and decide to purchase or something. So for me, I look at it more as like an opportunity, and I'm not scared about putting my stuff on Facebook and putting my stuff on Instagram. And I'm not like, I know, I read the terms, you know, I'm not like, I read
the
conditions and everything, but yeah, I think a lot of my generation, once it like aggressively embraces that stuff and not necessarily to our detriment. So,
Yeah, because the whole name of the game is creating opportunities.
Yeah.
That I think somebody once said that, you know, the artist or a writer or somebody, the thing that makes them famous is not the thing that they make money on.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the thing that gets their name out there, but then they go on and negotiate better deals afterwards. Before we wrap up, I want to ask you two how-to questions.
Okay.
The first how-to is, if somebody wants to get into this, what would you recommend?
Comics journalism?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm trying to start calling it a Kojo, but I don't know if that's going to catch on. Comics journalism?
No.
Capital J.
You work on that.
So we'll see how that goes. So if someone wants to get into Kojo, here's what I'd recommend. So there are some big books that are really great. Some of them, anything by Joe Sacco is wonderful. I think his masterpiece is probably Footnotes from Gaza. It's huge, but it is like just
really
great.
Really cool.
Yeah, it's a tremendous book. But maybe that's not the first thing you read. I might start with something a little bit more accessible, like Sarah Glidden is one of my contemporaries, and she has a book published by Vertigo a couple years ago called How to Understand Israel 60 Days or Less, in 60 Days or Less. And it's not straightforward journalism, but I don't mind putting her in this group because that's what she's pursuing now. And this is like the book that she kind of started
sort of
thinking
cut her teeth
about
on.
Yeah, and a lot of that stuff that you talked about before, about like metaphor that might not be right for journalism, and comicsy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
She uses that to amazing effect in her book. Like, she'll be staring out the window and just like picturing dinosaurs fighting and stuff like that. And I love it. And it's such a good book. And it really is like a memoir that once you're into Sarah, you'll kind of like keep following Sarah because her stuff is beautiful. After the Deluge by Josh Neufeld, and Pretty Much Everything by Josh Neufeld. Pretty awesome. If you want something quick, he has a great story on Atavist, the narrative nonfiction publishing site. It's a really good story about a undocumented worker traveling through the whole world, basically, and ending up in the United States in some weird territory. And you can get that. The iPad version is really fun because it's full of interactive stuff. There's some great, great shorter stories totally free on cartoonmovement.com. They have since stopped. They don't have any new stories in the pipeline, I don't believe. But this site, mostly funded by the Dutch government, has some awesome, awesome comics journalism from all over the world. They went to Haiti. They did some amazing work in Haiti. They had people in Afghanistan. Yeah, I hope they do more work because it's great. Some of my contemporaries who I have published a bit and I think are definitely guys to keep your eye on are Daryl Holliday and Eric Rodriguez Nelson. Oh, wait. No, I have that backwards. Eric Nelson Rodriguez. He's going to kill me. These guys are in Chicago, and they are a writer-artist duo, and they make some amazing work about Chicago. They do really great personal stories. Things like playing chess in the park and undocumented workers being deported out of Chicago and just people getting married in the jail. I have that in the Cartoon Picayune. It's a great story. I forget to mention Symbolia, too, is kind of like the Cartoon Picayune, but a souped-up, awesome version for the iPad. It's an iPad-only tablet magazine. Not only, I guess, they're on different platforms now, but they do amazing work. They pay people really well. Very proud of what they're able to do.
And the other how to question is how to, and you don't have to give me everything, but what should somebody do if they want to self-publish, if they want to
totally
go out? What should they be thinking about?
Well, mostly just start doing it. I think that's like the advice that everyone gives, but I think it's true. I mean, I really do think that no matter what you put on, say, like Tumblr. If you put something on Tumblr every day, people will read it no matter what it is. And
because people are just like that.
Yeah, I mean, that's just the way that community works, and it's awesome. And
people are just so hungry for content.
Listen, I know people who do fan fiction, right? And the fan fiction communities
on
Tumblr.
Comic world?
I'm just saying that there's more people. I have a friend who does fan fiction, and more people read her every day than even like remotely look at the Cartoon Picayune website, right? Like, and that's just like showing up and doing good work and having it reliably in one place.
What does she do fan fiction of?
Oh gosh, I think Hunger Games.
Okay,
Hunger Games.
Nice.
So yeah, I mean, know your audience, right? So,
but show up, do the work.
Yeah, exactly. I kind of think I love print. You know, I really love making these mini comics because for a long time, like as many people as have iPads and stuff, like until my girlfriend just got one, I had never seen Symbolia, which is a tablet app. And, you know, I can hand anyone a Cartoon Picayune, mm-hmm. they can read it and they'll know what I'm all about. Right.
Right.
And I love that like immediate accessibility. If I tell you like, well, it's comics, it's journalism,
right.
It's like a comic book, but it's kind of like This American Life. Like you might not know what I'm talking about, but as soon as you read it, I think you'll understand. It's just good stories.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's good stories told well.
Yeah,
I think
thanks.
It's probably a good place to wrap it up. Now, again, how can people find you?
Yeah, definitely. Can I mention a few events there in D.C.?
Yeah, mention a few events.
Sure.
This goes out to the world. We have
okay,
listeners
awesome.
In China.
Well, sure. That's great. But if you do happen to be in the D.C. area, I want you to know that I'm going to be at St. Stephen's Church on the 21st of July. At the DC Zine Fest, which is a really cool event if you've never been, totally free, really great. I'm going to be at, I'm going to be, if you're in Chicago, well, never mind about that.
Never mind.
Yeah.
here's a telephone number to call if you're out of Chicago. No.
If The Small Press Expo, September 14th and 15th, I believe, is amazing. It's in White Flint, Maryland, very easy to get to on the metro, and it's a great way to be overwhelmed by a ton of small press and comic books. And if you want to come say hi and buy my comics, I'm having a release party for this issue. I hope this will be out by the 21st,
we'll get a shot. Yeah, I think, yeah. Well, yeah. I think,
so you know, Friday, we'll 21st, I'm from 6 to 9 at, you can find all the information at the Cartoon Picayune or cartoonpicayune.com. But release party, June 21st, 923 F Street in Penn Quarter from 6 to 9. It's going to be
a comic book shop,
it's my studio.
It's your studio.
Share a studio with some lovely artists who are jewelry makers and painters. It'll be a great chance to see some of the original art that goes into making this stuff, and also drink some free drinks and to buy some comics.
And people could go to that website to get your
The new issue is out and it is awesome, so buy it.
Okay. Well, that's good. That's good. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you, guys.
Great talking to you.
I appreciate it.
Thanks.
You've been listening to It's All Journalism, a weekly podcast about the changing state of media.
You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or find out more information about It's All Journalism at itsalljournalism.com.
We'd like to hear what you have to say. If you have topics that you'd like us to cover or suggestions about who to interview, email us at editor@itsalljournalism.com.
Also look for It's All Journalism on Facebook and follow us on Twitter @alljournalism.